So please donate online at kboo.fm. Thank you so much for the support. We are unable to have such a great community radio station without a great community supporting us. So thank you to everyone from all of us here at KBOO, all the staff, all the volunteers. You guys make us what we are, and we are going to continue bringing you this great programming. So coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
I'd like to take time and thank the restaurants who donated food today. We'd like to thank Eclectic Kitchen, located at 4936 Northeast Fremont, serving breakfast and lunch, including gluten-free bread and pastry options. We'd also like to thank Marrakesh, located at 1201 Northwest 21st Avenue, open daily 5 to 10 p.m., belly dancing Wednesday through Sunday, serving Moroccan cuisine since 1989. Thank you very much for donating food for our volunteers during our fall membership drive.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to support More Love for Linda, a tribute and celebration of life for Linda Hornbuckle, who passed away Saturday, October 4th. A benefit concert was already planned to help raise funds for her medical bills and now will raise funds for the family debt and serve as a public tribute and celebration of Linda's life. More Love for Linda will be held Tuesday, October 14th from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Crystal Ballroom and will feature Quarter Flash, Soul Vaccination, the Linda Hornbuckle Band, and other special guests. Again, that's Tuesday, October 14th at the Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Amazing grace.
Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News, made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Lent's International Farmers Market, a program of Zinger Farm every Sunday through October at Southeast 92nd Avenue and Foster from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Lent's Farmers Market offers the Food Scouts Farmers Market Club for kids, a community table, cooking demonstrations, and live music. More at lentsfarmersmarket.org. This program is also made possible by the League of Women's Voters. The League of Women Voters of Portland, helping to make democracy work with election forums for the November election. Forums on October 14th and 15th will present local and state ballot measures, including marijuana legalization, GMO labeling, and driver's cards. Information at lwvpdx.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the voter ID laws are halted. Two voter ID laws are halted by rulings in federal court.
Malala Yousafzai becomes the youngest winner of the Nobel Peace Prize.
And Portland gets a new police chief.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, October 10th, 2014. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. Two federal court rulings today at least temporarily blocked the so-called voter ID laws, which impose new identification requirements on voters in various states. In Corpus Christi, Texas, U.S. District Judge Nelva Gonzalez-Ramos ruled that the Texas 2011 voter ID law is unconstitutional. She said that the time and money required for voters to meet the law's ID requirements amounts to a poll tax, and that the law discriminates against Latino and African American voters. Greg Abbott, the Texas Attorney General and Republican candidate for governor, said the state would immediately appeal the ruling. Also, the U.S. Supreme Court blocked a voter ID law in Wisconsin from taking effect, saying Wisconsin cannot implement major changes in voting procedures so close to the upcoming November election. the Wisconsin voter ID law, which was upheld by a lower court and in the process of being implemented, would require photo ID from all voters. However, some absentee voters in Wisconsin had already mailed in their ballots without photo identification before the law went into effect, which also bothered the Supreme Court. The court has used the same too close to election day logic, however, to support existing voter ID laws in such states as North Carolina and to enforce new limits to early voting in Ohio. This logic threatens the life of the new anti-voter ID ruling in the Texas case. Rick Hazen, an election law scholar, expects the anti-voter ID ruling to be blocked by a court of appeals or the Supreme Court before the November election, because courts have generally ruled that voting laws should not be changed so close to an election. If the Texas voter ID law remains blocked, it might help Democrat Wendy Davis in her campaign for governor, because she needs a strong showing from Hispanic, female, and African-American voters. If the law is allowed to go forward, it will help Republican Greg Abbott. Similarly, in Wisconsin, the Supreme Court's injunction of the voter ID law may help Democrat Mary Burke in her race for governor against incumbent Republican Scott Walker.
Representatives from the United Nations will be in Detroit this coming week. In June, a UN panel found that the massive residential water shutoffs in Detroit violated human rights. Despite this finding, a U.S. bankruptcy court judge ruled last month that water shutoffs would resume. With cold weather on the way, poor families, the elderly, and the infirm who find themselves without water may also go without heat due to the widespread use of radiators that depend on water. KBOO's Kristen Yount spoke with activist Miko Williams about the upcoming visit from the United Nations.
What is happening in Detroit? Just start at the very beginning. Why are people getting shut off, and why should we care?
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, Kristen, for having me on. Yes. Why should people care? Because the threat of our water commons in America has now grown to a fever pitch, to where corporations are getting away with not paying their fair share of bills, and they are sticking it on the residents and the taxpayers that they now want to come down and shut our water off for as little as $75. 40% of Detroit's population is at risk for getting their water shut off. There's currently now over 15,000 people or more that are facing water shutoffs. And this is not from, you know, not paying their bills. This is actually the inept, corrupt nature of the water department now coming to a head. They have been lax for a very long time. Part of years, and they have also faced some charges of mismanagement and ethics violations, to where a whole city now has to be aggressively shut off of its water if it do not pay its bills, but yet they don't want to accommodate the people that need it the most. They're just shutting our water off and not even giving us time to appeal or time to share our situation before it's too late. And we need people to care. We need the country has came and made the statement, water is a human right, heard around the world. And I thank them so very much for doing that. But now we need you to come and make that statement once more, because things have changed, but it still remains the same.
The UN came out and said that water is a human right in response to what was happening in Detroit. And now the UN is coming out next week. So can you tell us what you expect to happen next week?
When the UN gets here, we're going to have a very big celebration. We also want to have, starting on Friday, we're going to have a dinner for those that have pledged resistance on our website, DetroitWaterBrigade.org. And we're going to train them exactly, what we're going to be doing. I can't give those details out. But most definitely, we're taking a page from Ferguson, that we have exhausted all of our avenues, and now it's time to strike. You know, it's time to get in the streets. Saturday, I believe that is the 18th, we're going to have a rally for the UN, and we're going to have our own testimony. which is a solution-based session, which has never been done before. You know, when you usually get in rallies and marches, you know, they're all rallying to do one cause, but we want to propose a solution, and we want to get the consensus of the people that are involved. And then Sunday, the 19th, is the official town hall meeting, and we want to invite a lot of people to come and be a part of this. You know, the UN being here in the city of Detroit is a very big thing because Governor Rick Snyder could be slapped with some fines or charges. We don't know about that yet, but I'm pretty sure it'll be forthcoming as soon as all of the residents tell their stories about inadequate housing and also water being shut off.
Wouldn't it be crazy if a United States governor got slapped with human rights violations?
If he was to get slapped with a human rights violation, that would be the biggest among the U.S. Like, that would make headlines. But we want him to suffer a little bit, you know, because shut off people's water, if you cut people's education, and if you also compromise the quality of life for citizens here in the state of Michigan, you know, that constitutes as human rights violations. We come to find out there was only 4 complaints that was filed in the whole country. We're trying to build that number up here in the city of Detroit.
Thank you so much for talking to me. Can you just give us the web address where we can hear more about the Water Brigade?
Yes, please go to www.detroitwaterbrigade.org. Please donate to us by a charitable donation of any amount. We are still out in the streets. The fight is still not over. We are constantly expanding every single day to try to accommodate the many people that we come into service with by providing them water advocacy services. We take them down to the water department to talk about their situation and try to get them a fair, affordable payment plan without any contracts or restrictions. We really need help from the country. So if those of you will go to Detroit Water Brigade, www.detroitwaterbrigade.org, and donate to our organization, this would mean a lot. And also, people could give me a call if they want to have more information, 313-279-0608, extension 1, 279-0608, area code 313. And I would be more than happy to talk with anybody if they wanted to do a water donation drive to the city of Detroit. We still need a lot of help. And thank you to everyone that have participated and that have given.
That was Mika Williams from the Detroit Water Brigade, the after party. For KBOO News, I'm Kristen Yount.
Today marked the kickoff of a weekend of resistance in Ferguson, Missouri. Thousands of supporters converged in the Missouri town to call for justice for Mike Brown and police accountability nationwide. Here's a clip from the live stream this afternoon.
I came here to support the atrocities that are going on in this city, and I feel like the stuff that's going on here isn't right. It isn't transparent, and I also feel that, like, the police here has, like, no transparency and no accountability process. So I came here, like, stealing the truth, let the truth be known.
Tell me what the 5-second law is.
The 5-second law is when the police officer tell you that you have to keep moving while you're protesting, you can't stand there for more than 5 seconds. Nowhere else in the country than here.
What connections do you see between Ferguson and Palestine?
The connection I see between Ferguson and Palestine is that they're both people of color getting oppressed. And it's the same thing that's going on across the world. People of color across the world are being oppressed. And so when people of color come together, it's a threat. It's not considered a protest. All right, y'all, we about to go down right now. Be back out later on tonight, 7:30. Come back out tonight, 7:30. Stay here, tune in. Good.
That was a clip of the live stream from Ferguson, Missouri today. Actions are planned throughout the weekend with civil disobedience on Monday.
This week, Portland Mayor Charlie Hales announced that Portland Police Chief Mike Reese would be retiring in January 2015. Mayor Hales also named as successor Assistant Chief Larry O'Day. Many community members still know very little about the new Portland Police Chief. To find out more, KBOO's Ryan Katz spoke with Dennis Theralt, news editor of the Portland Mercury.
I'm wondering about our incoming police chief. Who is he and what's his background?
His name is Larry O'Day. He has been a Portland police officer since 1986. He has been an assistant chief since 2008. So he was put there by the previous police chief, Rosie Sizer, survived all through Sizer's replacement, Mike Reese. And, you know, he's known as a cop's cop, very much an operational genius, and he's taken to heart, apparently, a lot of people have told me, equity issues, diversity issues in the police bureau. And, you know, he shows up at community and police relations committee meetings where people talk about racial profiling. It's something he does more than just pay lip service to. He didn't get promoted with a national search. The mayor said, I took a measure of this man in the 2 years I've been mayor. I feel good about him. He's well-liked by police officers, but that people say that could be a good thing because he still pushes the Bureau to embrace things that Reese would have liked the Bureau to embrace diversity-wise, but he's got respect. He does not seen as an operator.
Why is this transitioning happening now? What's sort of the background here?
It's never been accepted that Mike Reese would sort of stay through the entire Hales administration. Charlie Hales inherited Mike Reese. Sam Adams appointed him in May of 2010 after firing Rosie Sizer. They had to finish the Justice Department settlement process. A federal judge in August finally approved our package of reforms aimed at easing use of force against folks with mental illness, changing training, other things. That was a big thing. You didn't want to change police chiefs in the middle of that. And the result, you know, Reese also, they didn't get along all the time, but they weren't necessarily enemies either. But, you know, you always want to have your own person in a job like that if you're the police commissioner. So, they were just finding a sensible way to save face and also to not destabilize the Bureau. I mean, I think it makes sense to have an orderly transition when you're not saying everything's completely wrong.
Mayor Hales, when he was going about this search, did he get input in from the community when he was undergoing this search?
He did not. There were community groups like the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform who actually had some standing as, you know, friends of the court during the federal reform negotiations. I mean, they were an important player in this. They're not just some people who said, hey, we want to have a say in this. They actually had real standing. The city cares about what they think. They did not get consulted. Other groups said the same. Even city commissioners didn't get the same thing. I'd heard that there were notes passed during a work session on marijuana taxation on Tuesday to the city commissioners. The Oregonian reported actually that those were cards and sealed envelopes. So people didn't know this was coming precisely. They knew generally this was going to happen, but there hadn't been a national search. The mayor said it would have been an exercise, not a real search, that he really liked Larry O'Day.
So you mentioned the settlement with the Department of Justice. What do we know about the possible implications for that relationship now that we have a new police chief, Larry O'Day?
O'Day has made implementing that settlement agreement one of his top priorities, and he's actually been pretty essential in the negotiations and he with the Justice Department going back to 2012 when they hammered out sort of the outline of these reforms. He was known for writing training materials as a officer and as, you know, a lieutenant and a captain as he moved his way up the ranks. He takes that very seriously. When he negotiated and helped negotiate these things, he knows what they're supposed to do, what they're supposed to say, why they're supposed to say it. So I don't think you're going to see any grand departures from that agreement. And I think there's still an argument by some community groups that this doesn't go far enough and that we need more change. But, you know, I don't know that he'll be the deliverer of that change, but he certainly is not going to work against the agreement.
Is there anything else that our listeners should know about the incoming police chief?
He's reviewed police shootings. He's been involved in police shootings not long in his job, so he brings some interesting perspective to this. But he really, people do say he has been more thoughtful over the years as he's advanced. And so we you know, he's very open. So I hope that's something that actually continues, that community groups still feel like they can go to him and that he doesn't close shop as the duties of the job pile up.
I have been speaking with Dennis Thorelt from the Portland Mercury. This is Ryan Katz with KBOO News.
African-American students at Portland State University are nervous about a proposal to create sworn police officers at the university and give them guns. The PSU Board of Trustees is considering the recommendation of a task force to replace the campus peace officers with sworn armed police officers. They would have powers to issue warrants and conduct investigations off campus. African-American student Diallo Bennett says the campus would be on track for another Keaton Otis if officers were armed. Referring to the 25-year-old black man shot dead by Portland police in 2010. The university claims arming officers will prepare them for a mass school shooting and help fight sexual assault. Black students at the University of Oregon in Eugene say that they avoid the campus when they see their newly armed campus police. 3% of Portland State students are black, totaling about 850 students. Danielle Ali Kasim, a black female PSU student, reports good experiences with police officers, but she worries for the young men of her color when she sees police. Phil Zerzan, Portland State's chief of campus public safety, says PSU has an opportunity to get policing right because the force would be required to follow the school's equity policy. The chief claims it doesn't make much sense to create a force with full police authority but no guns.
You are listening to an hour-long membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to thank everyone who contributed to KBOO's fall membership drive. We successfully reached our goal today. Woohoo! Thanks to all our friends that support the power of community-driven radio. Stay tuned for Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight on Bread and Roses, host Ashley Thurstrup will interview Elizabeth Nye of Girls, Inc. and Megan Kovacs of Raphael House in honor of the International Day of the Girl. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio News. Hard Knock Radio News and Views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be morning showers with a high of 71. Sunday will be mostly cloudy with a high of 78.
Mayor Charlie Hales has announced that he would like to extend the weekend street closures in Old Town, despite opposition from neighborhood businesses and residents. The extension will last for 1 year, but the mayor has said that he'll be flexible both about the boundary and about the time schedule. Three different committees studied the street closures in Old Town and found that the weekly barricades actually hinder business and make the area unwelcoming. Some businesses in the neighborhood have pushed back against the closure and succeeded in getting one lane of Northwest 3rd Avenue open to through traffic during the weekends. Mayor Hales will bring his proposed ordinance to City Council next week.
Yesterday, the federal government granted a temporary waiver for Oregon's Department of Education from the national standards of No Child Left Behind. This gives the state's education department another year to prepare for complying with the more stringent federal guidelines. The decision significantly impacts how much student test scores will factor into evaluations of their teachers. KBOO's Ryan Katz spoke with Jim Carlisle, assistant superintendent, and Teresa Richards, director of educational effectiveness, both at the Office of Learning in the Oregon Department of Education.
The news came out yesterday, that Oregon was approved for a waiver from the federal government. What does that mean, a waiver?
So what it means is that we no longer, as long as we have the waiver, would be responsible for the requirements that were passed in the early 2000s under what was called No Child Left Behind.
We're talking here about mostly about teacher evaluations, correct? What were those requirements of No Child Left Behind?
They had some goals that were set that had to be reached by 2014. Many of them would not have been reached by any school. Such things as all students would be reading at grade level by, you know, the third grade. And so that's why across the country, the vast majority of states have requested and received a waiver from that legislation.
But there was something about student test scores affecting that, correct?
Part of the evaluation of a teacher or a principal was based on how well kids learned to read at third grade, for example, and how much growth they made.
The waiver allows Oregon to develop its own standards. How are those different from the federal guidelines?
Well, for example, the U.S. office would like us to put a more stringent emphasis upon how well kids do on state tests. We're required to use those results as part of the evaluation. That will happen in a year from now.
So we are required to include state assessments after this school year, and they will count no more than 10% of the overall student learning and growth component of the evaluation system, over the overall evaluation system. So it's a very small percentage, and it is only for educators, teachers that teach in tested grades and subjects that our state tests measure, which is English, language arts, and math, and administrators who are responsible for the whole school.
One thing that I heard was that Oregon's plan in particular will allow each teacher, in consultation with the principal, to decide sort of how either test scores or other results will factor in to that and what size of it will. Do you mind explaining that a bit?
The teacher sets their student learning and growth goals in consultation or in collaboration with their evaluator, so their principal. And they determine what the needs are in their classroom, what are the needs of students, and what are the high priority standards or content that should be taught. And they determine what measures they would use. The majority of educators are not in the tested grades and subjects, but have to include measures from other content areas like social science or arts or so forth. They do collaborate on the goal and the kind of rationale for why they would select that goal, and they determine what the assessment would be. And then they measure that over the course of the year. The educator and supervisor consult during the course of the year and check on students' progress and see how it's going, and they adjust their strategies to make sure that they're helping all students grow. And in the end, they measure the growth of all students. And so they set goals based on the preparedness of each student that comes into the class.
I have been speaking with Jim Carlisle and Teresa Richards from the Oregon Department of Education. This is Ryan Katz with KBOO News.
Jerry Greenfield, co-founder of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream, jumped into Oregon's food labeling initiative yesterday by unveiling a new ice cream flavor to help the cause. The new flavor is called Food Fight. It'll be sold at 5 Oregon stores. The ice cream maker launched the same flavor in Vermont earlier this year to support the successful campaign that made Vermont the first state in the country to require labeling of all food ingredients containing GMOs. The taste you can expect from the new Oregon flavor is suggested by its full name, Food Fight Fudge Brownie. On November 4th, Oregon voters will decide the fate of Measure 92. It would make the state the next in the country to require labeling of GMO foods. Measure 92 is on track to become the costliest in Oregon history in terms of campaign contributions. Opponents of the measure have pumped more than $7 million into the campaign. Proponents have raised about $4.5 million. GMO labeling may raise consumer demand for GMO-free products on grocery shelves and a GMO-free food chain. 85% of Ben & Jerry's is entirely GMO-free. The company expects to be 100% GMO-free for all its flavors by the end of October.
The Baltic state of Estonia became the first former republic of the Soviet Union to legalize same-sex partnerships, to take effect starting in January 2016. Estonian President Tomas Hendrik Ilves, a strong supporter of same-sex partnerships, signed the bill into law Thursday after the Estonian parliament voted 42 and 38 against, with 23 abstentions, to pass the bill. Under the new law, Estonian same-sex couples will enjoy most but not all of the same rights that opposite-sex couples enjoy. Gay partners will have the right to adopt their partner's biological children, but same-sex Estonian couples will not have full adoption rights for any child. The couple will have full financial, social, and health benefits. Kari Kasper, the director of Estonia's Human Rights Center, said that Estonia has made a leap towards a society that is freer, more equal, and that values human rights for all. The center also hailed the vote as historic, saying it would send a strong message to neighboring Russia. As the 23rd anniversary of the dissolution of the former Soviet Union approaches, the former client states of the USSR continue evolving into two camps: liberal democracies that increasingly respect minority rights and authoritarian societies that are homophobic, such as Kyrgyzstan. In the middle is Ukraine and Moldova, which have made some moves towards equal rights for same-sex couples and other minorities. These two nations are interested in joining the European Union, which requires equal rights for all member countries.
Today, Malala Yousafzai heard the news that she was chosen for the Nobel Peace Prize when she was in chemistry class. The 17-year-old is the youngest recipient of the prize. Ms. Yousafzai was targeted as a child for speaking out for the Afghani girls and their right to an education on a BBC Urdu blog in 2009. Taliban fighters boarded her school bus and shot her and her friends. She survived the attack and went on to be an outspoken advocate for education. She shares the prize with filmmaker and anti-human trafficking champion Kailash Satyarthi. They'll split the $1.4 million pot.
The besieged Syrian Kurdish border town of Kobane is the latest test of strength in the battle against ISIS insurgents in the region.